Welcome back to Finding Our Balance. In episode 16, we chat with Richard Maltby, a 32-year-old father from the UK, a wannabe athlete, and a fitness enthusiast living with brain cancer.
Rich was living in Sydney, Australia with his partner Louise and beautiful one-year-old son Jackson when his life was turned upside down after being diagnosed with a grade 3 incurable but treatable brain cancer. His diagnosis left him with no other option than to move back to the UK where he could get treatment and be around the support of his friends and family.
In this episode, Rich shares with us his life now living with cancer, the stigma around men's mental health and the struggle faced on a day-to-day basis. He reveals how his biggest motivation is his son and how he's determined to beat his prognosis.
Rich is one of the strongest people that I have met, and he hopes that his story will make other people feel more comfortable speaking about their tough times and understand that no one needs to struggle by themselves. He lives by the motto, play the hero, not the victim.
Please note that due to Rich being overseas, the connection was a little bit unstable. We really hope that you enjoy this episode as much as we enjoyed chatting to Rich.
Rich, thanks so much for joining us today. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. Thank you very much for having me on.
No, that's not a problem at all. I actually met Rich over 2 years ago when we both signed up for our first boxing fight through the Corporate Fighter 12-week program. So we went through a grueling 12 weeks and then we both won our fights, which was exciting. So that was a good time. Just to start off with one question today, what's your typical morning routine?
So I tend to get up quite early because I'm a morning person. So anything from, even if I have my little boy or whatever, I get up around 6 o'clock and I've started in the last kind of 6 months to write a gratitude diary and a to-do list diary every morning. So I have 3 things that I will list as gratitude. So that could be my family, my wealth, or whatever, and then I have 3 things on a to-do list. And then what I try and, for my morning routine, this does change a little bit, but I like to try and achieve something quite early to set myself for the day. So that could be, it could be something really silly, like I shave my head now, so I might shave my head at like 6:30 in the morning because I've got a head start on the day, so I don't have to do it later. I started getting into meditation when I found out about my illness as well. So I meditate every morning without fail for 5 minutes, and that's just mainly through breathing techniques, not through a guided meditation anymore, but I used to use a guided meditation because I feel like a morning routine, it has to be flexible. I am a young father, so it needs to be flexible with what I'm doing. So if I can get a few things done, such as a meditation, a gratitude list, a to-do list, then I feel like I've made 50% of the day ready to rock and roll, basically.
Yeah, start the day, win the morning, win the day.
Exactly.
And so talk us through your lifestyle pre-cancer diagnosis. So you were living in Australia for how many years?
Six and a half years, Australia, yeah.
And so what was life like living in Australia for you?
I was a typical pommy. Lived in the suburbs my whole time, between Bondi, Bronte, Surrey Hills. Had a small stint in Alexandria, didn't like that, so went straight back to Bronte. I was in recruitment, like every English person. But I very much lived and breathed the kind of Sydney lifestyle. You know, I used to run to work from Bronte to the CBD in the morning, which is about 6 kilometres. Used to work, then I'd go to the gym at lunchtime, then I'd finish work and maybe even run back if I was feeling up for it. Probably went to every single coffee place you could think of in Bondi and Bronte.
So trendy.
Yeah, exactly. So my partner and I, we absolutely loved it in Australia. It was like our perfect kind of lifestyle combination of work-life balance and good financial gain as well. Before I moved back to the UK, actually, that was when it was probably at our peak, when we had a lovely flat in Bronte where we could see the beach. Our son was going to daycare, so my partner was back at work, I was back at work. We were living a kind of life of fitness and parenthood. It was, yeah, it was pretty awesome. Yeah, good times. Yeah. Love Australia. Yeah.
When was your son Jackson? When was he born?
He was born September 7th, 2018.
So he's a Aussie boy.
Yeah, he's got a dual passport, the lucky boy. Because, my partner's got PR and I was on sponsorship at the time. So he's got a English passport, which we got him, and he's got an Australian passport. So he is one lucky guy in the future, that's for sure.
So lucky. Very, very jealous, that's for sure.
So talk us through a little bit about your cancer story in terms of when you were diagnosed, what was it like, some symptoms, and kind of just start from the beginning.
Yeah, it's just, well, I guess every cancer journey is different. But obviously, so my one began, I started having kind of like tremors in my little finger on my left hand. And this happened, the first time it happened was after a run into work, and it happened. And I thought, oh, it's just cramp or, you know, like a trapped nerve or something like that. So I just kind of completely brushed it off, didn't tell anyone. And then it happened probably a week later. Then it kept happening and happening and happening. Probably still kind of just, you know, typical bloke, don't care. Like, it's fine, it's nothing. So then I went to a GP and they put me through just a standard blood test to check all my kind of mineral levels and everything like that. They came back completely fine. So then he referred me to a neurologist who would be someone to check over kind of like my brain, my nervous system. Again, never really thought about anything. So I went and saw a neurologist. He said, okay, you need to have a scan, an MRI. I put that off for 2 months. I didn't go have the scan. I came back to the UK for a month to see family with Jackson and Louise. Was still having the slight tremors while I was in the UK, but everyone was telling everyone, I think I got a feeling it's just a trapped nerve. And then they started happening daily. And then I started to actually feel them before they would happen. It sounds quite strange, but I could tell in my mind that it was going to happen. So that's when I started to record them on my iPhone so that I could show the neurologist. So we got back from the UK and I went for my MRI on a Friday night, down south in Miranda, in my car, on my own, had the scan. And then they said to me, oh, you've had one scan, but we can't do the second scan because there's no doctor here to inject you with the dye that you need. I said, oh, it's okay, I'll put off my doctor's appointment, don't worry. So my doctor's appointment was the next day, or the Monday, sorry. And I put that off and I said, look, sorry, I haven't been able to get the other MRI done yet. So there's no point meeting. And then they called me that day and said, oh, Rich, can you please come in? There's something come up in the scan that you did do. So it was lunchtime. I was in the CBD, went over to North Sydney to see the neurologist on my own. I never really thought, I didn't have a clue it was going to be what it was. I thought it would be maybe some real bad nerve damage, or I thought it was maybe early MS because it was like a shake. And that quite scary to think that. But he sat me down and said, oh, look, something's come up. It's a brain tumour. So then straight away, you know, you just go, well, what does that mean? You know, because you don't really know. Like, I didn't know anything about brain tumours. And he kind of said to me, do you have any questions? And I said to him, I don't have any questions because I just don't know how to process it. So he said to me, what you're going to need to do, I said to him, how does it look to you? And he's not a cancer specialist. And he just said, oh, it looks like it's kind of small. Looks like it will be fine, reassuring me. And then he referred me to a doctor called Dr. Parkinson in North Sydney. So he referred me to a Dr. Parkinson. So I came out of the appointment, rang my partner, Louise, told her over the phone, and then just kind of broke down in North Sydney train station. Yeah, it was pretty surreal situation that time. And then I went back to work. Kind of everyone knew that I had been to see the doctor, and I just kind of sat still, and people knew that there was something wrong with me. So I went and spoke to my boss and said, this is what's happened. I probably need to go home and talk to Louise. So yeah. And then went and told Louise, got an appointment with Dr. Parkinson a few days later. And he kind of brought up the scan, showed me what it was. And it was, the tumour was probably the size, a golf ball and a half. And it was in my right frontal lobe of the brain. And the reason I was having the tremors in my hand was they were mini seizures. So the tumour was pressing on my coordination for my left side. And he said to me straight away, he's like, you're going to have an operation to remove it. So there was no like, we could leave it and see how it develops. It was like, you have to have the operation or you will die, basically. So that was quite surreal.
Wow, that's insane. And it's not something that you, I guess it's, you just never expect you. And that's the thing with the doctor, and you're like, you just think it could be something small. And then when they say something like that, you can't even imagine how you would feel. It's just crazy.
Frontal lobe, that's responsible for speech, isn't it?
No, it's well, they told me it was responsible for my kind of left coordination. It didn't affect my speech. But it was pressing on basically a part where it would have function on my left side, and didn't have any problems with my speech at the time. But later down the track, I actually did as well. So then we had the 5-hour awake craniotomy removal. And then after you have that done, they send off the tumour to find out if it's a cancerous tumour, do a biopsy on the tumour. And I had to wait 3 weeks for the results on that. So that was just, that was a real tough time for me and my family. Yeah.
What was it like being awake during surgery?
Sure, it was very surreal. There was probably around about 15 people in the surgery room with me. I had, obviously the surgeon was behind me. I had a sheet over my head down towards my toes, so I could only kind of see down towards my feet and to the side of me. And then I had a really kind nurse who held my hand and would speak to me. But you can hear and you can feel everything. It's only local anaesthetic. So you can hear the saw, you can feel the drill. So it was very surreal. And they would get me to do like the alphabet, get me to move my hands, get them to talk to me about my family, so that my memory wasn't getting affected, what my name was. And it was it felt like a very, very long time, if I'm being honest. It felt like I was there for hours and hours and hours, because they had to clamp my head in as well. So they had to drill in just near my temples, each side, to clamp my head as tightly as possible so that I wouldn't move. So a very uncomfortable 5 hours of my life, that's for sure.
Yeah, I can imagine. That's just given me shivers. I think we're both
of you. Yeah, it's full on. It's crazy that you had to go through something like that.
So fast forward the 3 weeks post-surgery, and do you remember, like, where were you when you got the diagnosis? What happened? And talk us a little bit through that when the doctor read out your diagnosis.
Yeah, so we were waiting such a long time, and we were getting kind of frustrated that it was taking a long time. So we kind of pushed it more and more with the doctor contacting him pretty much every couple of days. And then he finally got the results, and I went with my mum and my dad flew over from the UK for the surgery. So they were with me as well. So we all went to see the doctor. And as doctors do, they gave us all this different science and these different things. And he was like, oh, it's a mutation 3 and a mutation 2. And I was just like, I don't have a clue what you're saying, but I was nodding my head, pretending like I did. And then basically said to him, look, I just need to know kind of black and white what it is. And he said to me, unfortunately, it is a grade 3. They call it an astrocytoma, which is a grade 3 tumour, which basically means that the tumour, the cells, have mutated, which will mean that it's spread elsewhere in the brain. So it will spread around the tumour. And they will grow back at some point. It might be slow, it might be fast. It's pretty unpredictable. But a grade four would have been where it's a very fast growing cell development. So basically he said to me, your next steps are you will need radiotherapy and you will need chemotherapy and you will be diagnosed as a cancer patient, basically. Yeah.
Wow. And so basically they told you that was your treatment options. Did they give you sort of any future things to do or it was just short term?
It was just short term because I guess my situation was quite different because, which I'm sure we might go into, but I'm obviously from the UK and I was living in Sydney just with my partner and my son. Mm-hmm. I had my sister living over there, but I didn't have obviously my parents or any other kind of support. So that was the only thing that I could do. He said that you will have to have that done or it will grow back very quickly. And your chances of life would be cut down to kind of 12 months or maybe even less or maybe a little bit more. So that's where things got kind of a little bit complicated because, as I mentioned at the start, I was on a sponsorship and my partner was on PR and my son obviously has a dual passport.
Yeah.
And I was actually in the progress of getting my PR, so my permanent residency, sorry. And that unfortunately got declined when I found out I had cancer. So it basically meant our hand was completely forced and we would have to move home. So because the government, I guess, in Australia did not want to have to do the cost of my treatment. We could have probably fought it and fought quite hard. But with all the stress that we had on already, we thought we'd just kind of cut our losses and we'll move back to the UK and do my treatment there.
So they declined your permanent residency because you got diagnosed with cancer?
Yes, correct. Yeah, mad.
That's terrible.
So bad.
If you would want to stay here after that anyway.
It was quite a difficult decision because we kind of knew that because my cancer is an incurable cancer and it's something that I will have to live with for however long I live with, it kind of meant if I leave, then it's going to be very hard for me to go back because I'm always going to be, when I do the health declaration to get back into Australia, I'm always going to have to highlight the fact that I have cancer. Mm-hmm. So obviously she was very supportive and we all decided to move back and have the family support and do the treatment in the UK. So it was an easy decision because our hand was forced, but it felt quite unfair and quite unjust to be pushed into that situation, basically.
Yeah. And so you moved back to the UK and talk us through a bit of your treatment that you went through when you got home.
Yeah, so I came back, like I said, September 2019. All I had was a letter from the doctor in Australia saying he had done a brain surgery and that I had a grade 3 tumour and cancer. And believe me, the UK is very, very hard to get any kind of treatment quickly. So mm-hmm. I had to register with a GP. I had to go see a GP, show them the forms, say, look, I need to see someone quite quickly. Then they had to refer me to a hospital, then I had to go to a hospital, and then they had to refer me to an oncology doctor. So I got back in September, and I didn't get treated until December. That's how long it was.
Wow.
I was telling my mum the other day that I was going to be on this podcast, and she said to me, she basically works for the NHS here in the UK. And she would hunt them on a daily basis, trying to get my information across to the doctors. And she got to the point where she would even call like the receptionist and be like, don't let my son die. He needs to see someone. So it was a very, very hard, stressful point. That's for sure.
Whoa,
That's insane. And that you had to wait that long to get the treatment and travel in, that must have been so stressful for you and your partner and your son. That's so hard. It
was a very stressful time.
So along with your radiation and other medical treatments, have you been doing any other natural or like holistic style of methods to help with the recovery?
Yeah, so I'm pretty into my health and fitness and nutrition and different bits. So I researched a lot when I found out about the tumour and looked into the ketogenic diet. So the ketogenic diet was created in the 60s to help young children with seizures. So basically, if you start, the point of the ketogenic is obviously to have no carbohydrates or very moderate carbohydrates, very high fats, to kind of kick yourself into ketosis, where you're burning fat as fuel rather than glucose or the carbohydrates that you've consumed. And the basis of how that can help with a brain tumour is that a tumour can feed off glucose and can feed off carbohydrates. There's still a lot of science that needs to go into it, but I thought, why not? Let's give that a go. So I went completely keto for probably, say, 2 months, where I had a high-fat, low-carb diet, moderate protein. And I gave that a go, but it's really hard to obviously track your results with that. You don't know how it's affecting your tumour. All you know is how it's affecting your mood and how you feel. And I lost way too much weight. I lost, I think, 5 kilos in the space of 4 weeks. And I'm quite a slim guy anyway.
Yeah.
And people said to me, you know, you're looking... And I was training a lot still, even... Throughout this whole period, I was still training on a daily basis. Even when I came out of hospital, I would still train. So I said to myself, I was like, I'll save the ketogenic for a rainy day. Like if it gets to a point where the doctor says to me, look, we've done everything we can, then I will return to that and give it a go. So I'm not keto at the moment. I just have a balanced diet between all the three macros, basically.
Yeah.
And then the other approach I tried was CBD and THC,
yeah,
which is a very kind of up in the air topic, but I take CBD on a daily basis still. So in the UK, you can legally buy CBD. So it has no THC in it, which is the thing that makes you high. Mm-hmm. And I take that basically for the health benefits of lowering anxiety, helping with sleep, so helping me recover from chemotherapy, basically. But there is studies, well, there is some research into how THC can help shrink cancer. So you probably would have seen in the news, like there's always the odd case of someone who's cured their cancer with cannabis. So my dad knows a bit about cannabis, let's just say, from his youth. And he kind of took it upon himself to do a lot of research into it. And basically that gave him like a project of hope to help kind of cure my cancer. Mm-hmm. So he found someone on the kind of black market who was basically producing THC oil for his wife who had cancer. So I gave that a go, and let's just say I did not like feeling that high. It was so yep. potent, so strong, but I would take it before I went to sleep, and I'd lay in bed and feel like I was floating in the air. It was crazy. and that was definitely not for me. When you have to get up and look after your 10, it was Jack being 11 months old, 12 months old, or 15 months old, sorry. You don't want to feel like you're high. So I've, again, kind of stopped that for a rainy day.
Mm.
Like if it gets to a point where the doctors say we've done everything you can, then I have no doubt, then I will give that a good go and yeah. I'll try to keep diet again. So that's the kind of holistic approaches or the non kind of standard approach to what I've tried. And I'm definitely open to that, and I still research it today and look at read stories and listen to podcasts on both those things.
For sure. Have you looked into any other diets? Like, for example, I'll send you this book. I'm not sure if you've heard about it, but it's called How Not to Die. It's not very exciting cover, but it sort of like goes into how to prevent and reduce symptoms and that sort of thing of specific cancers, diseases that people can potentially get as they get older. And it does go through a lot of different diets. Obviously, it does focus primarily on like a vegan diet. I don't know if you've looked much into that, but I'll send you it anyway. It might be a good read if you want something else to do some research.
Definitely send it through. The other approach was I was looking at a plant-based diet, and I feel like a plant-based diet is good for many other cancers, but because of brain cancer and where the tumour is stored and it's in your brain, it's very hard to get nutrients to the brain.
Okay.
So that's why ketosis is the only way really to try and get it to focus on the brain. So initially, straight away, when I found out I had cancer, I was like, oh, okay, I'm going to go vegan, I'm going to do this.
I'm going to do yoga,
meditation, I'm going to basically hum every day for 3 hours and I'm going to feel better and I'll just eat carrots or whatever. But to be honest with you, and I'm still open to trying all these different things, but I am very much an 80-20 person. You know, 80% of the time I live a healthy life. 20% of the time I drink alcohol, I eat sweets, I party still, you know, like you have to have that balance or you just feel like you're kind of just slowing the inedible, basically, that you're going to pass away at some point. So it's striking the balance of everything really is the key, I believe. And for myself.
Yeah, you still got to live your life and enjoy it while we all can. Like, life is so precious and you don't want to spend the whole time being like, oh, I can't eat this, can't do that. Like,
and I think for your mental health, that's such a big thing as well. Like, if you're happy with what you're eating and what you're doing, that's so important for your mental health. And going into my next question, how do you cope mentally on a day-to-day basis? You mentioned you listen to podcasts and you do yoga and exercise. But how do you cope with those bad days that you obviously have sometimes?
Yeah, so I'm a big advocate of talking about mental health. I think it's really strong for people to say that they're vulnerable and that they suffer. I have really suffered in this whole time to the point of feeling extremely low, to having thoughts that I never thought I would have. Feeling like a burden on people that I love and who love me. And I guess the way that I overcame that, and I still deal with it probably on a daily, weekly basis now, is by talking about it with people who you feel comfortable talking to about it. I do listen to podcasts. I listen to a podcast called Project You, which is by a guy called Craig Harper, who's down in Melbourne. And he has loads of different guests who have gone through hardships or sporting people who've had difficult times. And I can relate to that in a way which helps me kind of sit back and think, you know what, I haven't got it too bad. You know, I'm here, I've got a good life still. And I basically use that as motivation to kind of kick myself back into a good state. And then the other thing which helped me hugely is just breathing and meditation, you know. So after my brain surgery, when I was in the hospital in North Sydney, I was suffering really badly with acute stress disorder. So obviously I'd had this huge thing that happened and I struggled to talk to anyone. I didn't want anyone to be near me. I felt claustrophobic, even though I was in a huge ward. And a psychologist who was at the hospital said to me, why don't you try this app called Smiling Mind? Mm-hmm. And I still use it pretty much every day for the last kind of year. And it basically has helped me learn about meditation, and how to use it to kind of calm my nervous system, calm my anxiety, calm pretty much everything from trying to go to sleep, from silly little things like I'll slow down now when I eat, when I walk through the woods, I'll appreciate the birds and the trees. You know, like I was a typical 29-year-old, 30-year-old bloke who liked a beer, played football, but liked going to the gym, didn't care about trees or birds or anything like that. And now I walk around kind of appreciating nature to really kind of bring myself back down to earth, basically, and kind of slow my mind and don't overthink things. And I very much live by the mantra, you can only control what you can control. So control the controllables and try and leave everything else behind you or in front of you and live in the present day rather than trying to think about the past or trying to think about the future. Yeah. I think for many people who have cancer, who I've spoken to, the future seems very bleak all the time, because especially if you have something which you know will get you at some point, you don't know when it will be. You always live in this horrible kind of bubble of, well, at some point I might die. And I know, and people say this to me all the time, well, I might get hit by a bus tomorrow.
Yeah.
If you're a person who says that to someone who's got cancer, then I'm not going to use a swear word, but just don't say it. Just don't say it, because it's not a nice thing and it's not the same, because you don't walk around thinking I could get hit by a bus at any moment. So
yeah, that's very true. And I think everything you just said is very beautiful, and I think it's
appreciating the small things is so important. Yeah. Do you feel like now that you've been diagnosed with cancer that people walk around sort of on eggshells around you or don't know how to approach different conversations with you?
Certain personality types do.
Yeah.
And then other personality types are quite forward. So yeah. With my close friends, I'm quite happy to joke about it.
Yeah.
And you know, I use humour to kind of start a conversation, where other people who don't want to talk about kind of, let's say, for instance, mental health, which has a big thing in cancer, will definitely kind of tread eggshells around me. But I'm very open. And that's kind of why I agreed to do this podcast, because I think it's very hard for young people to find out information from other young people about cancer. It's really, really difficult. And it's really difficult to hear stories. All you hear is kind of stories of people in their 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s who get cancer and unfortunately pass away, where there's thousands and millions of people in the world who are in their 20s, 30s, in their teens, under 10, who are going through this. And you don't hear about it as much from a personal level. So talking about it is huge, and I've encouraged all the people around me to ask questions and say to me, how do you feel, or I'm really confused by this, like, what do you mean, what's your prognosis? And prognosis is a very difficult conversation to have with people. You know, it was something that I knew straight away, but my mum put off with the doctor for 6 months. She didn't want to know. Because you know, it made her feel uncomfortable. So I think talking about things is just, with everything, with health, it's so vital to do it, or you're just going to basically hold it all in and it'll just explode.
Explode.
Yeah.
Exactly.
That's for sure. From a day-to-day life, are you in any pain or do you feel anything?
No. So I'll quickly explain so at the moment I'm doing chemotherapy, which is basically every 4 weeks I do a week of chemotherapy. So I am now, this coming Monday is when I will start chemotherapy again. And then I do the chemotherapy for 5 days, and then I have 3 weeks to recover, and then I start again, basically. I'm never in any pain, but I feel very fatigued. It affects your mood. So I can be quite grumpy, and people say that I can be grumpy anyway. So that doesn't help. And then, so never in any pain, don't ever feel kind of like I'm going to vomit or be sick. But for someone who's very active like myself, feeling fatigue is probably, I hate it.
Yeah.
And fatigue is very, is overlooked by a lot of people. Mm. Like when you can't do what you would normally want to do, you know, it's kind of soul destroying. You know, like I like to go for a walk, I like to run, I like to lift weights, I like to play sport. And when you feel so low, so tired, and you don't want to do that, it can really affect you mentally and then physically as well. The best way I can describe it, think of your worst hangover you've ever had, and it's basically like that.
Wow.
That's what chemotherapy feels like for me.
And do you need the whole 3 weeks to recover from that in terms of the fatigue, or how long for you does it normally last that you're feeling really tired and down?
It doesn't take the whole 3 weeks. It probably takes, I have the 5 days where I'm on, and then it probably takes about 4 days after that to get back to feeling pretty good. So obviously at the moment I start on Monday, so I feel excellent today. Like yesterday I played tennis for 3 hours in 30 degrees. I lifted weights. I cycled to the doctor, had my blood test, cycled back. You know, so at the moment I feel like $1 million, but I know that it's coming, so I have to kind of scale things down to approach it in the right way, or, you know, it just becomes frustrating, basically.
Yeah, you seem to, like, push yourself quite a lot when you can. I follow you on, obviously, your Instagram stories, and you go for, like, really long runs sometimes. I'm like, I can't even do that. I don't know how he pushes himself to do that. It's amazing.
Your son and your partner, how has your relationship with them changed, and you've been... how have they been feeling about it all?
Yeah, so my partner Louise has been awesome throughout. She's very much a kind of closed book when it comes to things like talking about the cancer. And I've kind of learned that there's no point in me trying to push that on her, because that makes her feel uncomfortable. So she's more there from a support of positivity and doesn't like to talk about the negative side of things, and it's probably brought us closer from a emotional standpoint. But it's been very difficult, you know. She had to leave her life behind, mainly because of me. I know it was completely out of my control, but she had a great job. She had a huge amount of friends and support in Australia. She loved her life, and she had to leave that, and we had to move back and in with her parents, you know. So that's quite an extreme thing to go through, but there's light at the end of the tunnel. She's just bought a brand new house all off the back of her own money and supported me, so it's just pretty incredible what she's done with that. And she's got a fantastic job here now, and she's just been excellent, really. And then when it comes to my son, he is, and I think Leo will know this from my Instagram, he is literally like my everything. He is
such a cutie.
Yeah, he is the most gorgeous boy. I know I'm his dad, so I'm going to say that. But
<You're biased. laughs>
he is the biggest motivation for me to beat cancer. That is for sure. Like, I want to beat it for my own self, but the biggest motivation is to be around when he hits his teens, when he hits his 20s. You know, that is really quite important for me to try and be there for him. Yeah, he is the biggest star in my life, that's for sure. And he's becoming a little character, and he looks just like me when I was a little boy, and, you know, he's just brilliant. Yeah, so he is literally the biggest motivation you could ever have, that's for sure.
And so what about, like, work-wise? You're obviously not working or anything at the moment.
No, so a funny story, really, I guess. Everyone says to me that I think that I'm invincible. And I guess when I finished my radiotherapy, which was in December, early January, and that was 6 weeks of every day in the hospital getting the radiation on my brain, basically. And I said, I'm fine, I'll go back to work. And I threw myself into a recruitment job, which is a very high sales driven role. And I went for one day, And I sat there and I did it and I was phoning strangers, talking to them about bloody recruitment. And I said, and I left the office and I rang Louise and my mum actually. And I said, there's no chance I'm going back and doing that. And I just didn't go back. And I went for one day. And it kind of basically made me realise that I wasn't ready, like from a mental health perspective. I felt physically okay. But, you know, you have to have a certain kind of mentality to do that job anyway. And if you're not feeling, you know, super positive and you're not feeling motivated by money, then it wasn't really the right thing to do. So I haven't been working for quite a long time now, especially with the pandemic and the COVID here and the lockdown. It's been very hard for me to find a job, but I'm hoping to move into basically to care. I want to move into kind of a social care worker role. So I'm hoping over the next kind of coming months that I can, I've had interviews and I've got offered jobs, but they haven't really worked from a hourly perspective. It's quite long hours in social care, and I've obviously, my family's very important to me. So I'm still trying to kind of find that balance with that. But I know for basically, I think the best happiness you can have is by helping others. Yeah. So if I can get a job where I'm helping others, and I know that will help my own health as well, because I will get a lot of reward, and it doesn't even matter to me about financials, that's for sure. Money is very redundant when you find out you have cancer, that's for sure.
Imagine. And it's also helping other people. You're focusing on them and you don't have to always focus on your own problems. So it gives you something to take your mind off things.
Exactly. And that's so true. And I get a lot of joy out of talking to people and trying to help them from a fitness perspective, a mental health perspective, because it kind of shuts your own problems and you can also relate to yourself. So yeah, it's 100% true.
Incredible. So what is some advice that you would give to people who may have been diagnosed or are going through cancer treatment at the moment?
The number one thing, which I think, and this is with cancer, it's with all health things, you have to take charge of your own health. You can't just let a doctor dictate your path, because that doctor will see probably, let's say, minimum of 20 patients, you know, and everyone's different, and you have to take charge and push things and really kind of, if you're waiting on a prognosis or a diagnosis, and you're not hearing things, and you should chase that doctor. You should really take charge of things. You should research things. You should do everything in your power to understand what's going on with you. A lot of people who I've spoken to going through similar things, and this is mainly through Facebook groups, through charities, tend to neglect the fact that they can take charge of their own health and that they literally just take the guidance of a doctor. And doctors are amazing, but they are very governed by rules and regulations and saying the right thing. Like, I'll give you an example. My prognosis is 2 years, you know, like 2 years and then I might die. But if you talk to people and you do the research, you know, there's people with grade 3 brain tumor like myself who have lived for 10 years, you know, and they don't talk about that because they talk about the simple facts. And a lot of them people who would have passed away, unfortunately, would have probably have had different health issues, wouldn't be 30 years old, wouldn't be exercising, wouldn't be living a good, healthy life balance. So you can't take that as gospel and live with that over your head. So you need to kind of motivate yourself to do the research and do the positive research and look at it in a light of, how can I change things? How can I dictate how I feel? What about my mental health? How can I learn about mental health and deal with that situation? It is difficult because there's quite confronting conversations you have to have, and you have to be very open to the fact that you're going to hear things that you don't want to hear. And it is it's hard, especially here in the UK. It's very hard to get information. Like, I found it a lot easier in Australia to be able to talk to people about mental health. Here, you know, you have to jump through hoops to see a therapist, where in Australia you can pay a couple of hundred bucks and you'll see someone tomorrow. But yeah, that's my number one advice, is just take charge of your own health and your own kind of research, and do things that feel comfortable for you, but go out of your comfort zone to learn things and take charge of what your life will be like.
Yeah, no, that's really good advice. And as you say, like, you see people that beat cancer, you see people who beat those prognoses. Anyone can do it. So it's just having that positive attitude, and you've got your family and you've got so much support that's there to help you. So you just got to keep going. And you're such a strong person. We can see that already. Like, it's incredible.
And one of the things I always say, and this was a guy called Jeff Jowett. Again, he's an Australian guy. If anyone follows him on Instagram, he's great. He says, play the hero, not the victim. So I don't want to be the victim. I want to be the hero. I want people to look at me and go, wow, he actually overcome it, rather than, oh, his personality changed. He didn't want to go out. He didn't want to talk to people. You know, he didn't exercise. He became his disease. I'd rather be the hero where people go, wow, look at what he did. He is the science of the new kind of development. And I think that statement is so strong. Play the hero, not the victim, is huge. And that could be across anything.
I love that. That's so powerful.
And it kind of eases into our last question, is who is someone that inspires you? I guess you inspire yourself in a way.
Yeah, so this is when you sent me over like the basis of some of the questions we talked to in this conversation. I really kind of rattled my brain with this one.
Yeah.
Because I didn't want to say someone like David Beckham, because I love David Beckham and how
we all love David Beckham.
Yeah. I definitely have a huge man crush on him, and he's been like my hero ever since I was 5 years old or whatever. But I definitely take inspiration from myself. I take inspiration. So, for instance, yesterday I had an MRI in the hospital, and it's very different here at the moment. You can't really go into hospital with anyone else. And there was a young boy who obviously had cancer. He was going through his chemotherapy, and he was about to have his MRI. People like him inspire me. You know, he wasn't in tears. He was being strong. He probably was only 13 years old. He was there on his own, and I just thought, how can I ever complain when I've got that young boy going through probably maybe even harder what I'm going through, is probably so confused about life, confused about everything. So I take huge inspiration from people like that. Basically, everyday people inspire me. Good dads, I take a lot of inspiration from dads who I kind of aspire to be. I think being a good father is probably overlooked by so many people. And then I have a close friend, a guy called James Yates, who he's a supermodel, I call him. He is a model, and he's a very good looking boy. He has a huge amount of following on Instagram, but his kind of approach to life and health and mental health is quite inspiring to me. Like, he always checks in with me, even though we weren't best friends before this happened, but we were close friends. He will happily call me when he's out for a walk. He will happily talk openly to his 150,000 followers about the mental struggles that he goes through. And I think there's so much strength and inspiration through people, especially men, who can be vulnerable about what's going on in their lives. So I'd like to give a mention to him, because he definitely inspires me. And he's a bloody good looking boy. He's very good.
We're
going to
give him a little follow.
Yeah.
Oh, that's excellent. So I guess you've kind of gone over what's next for you in regards to career options. It's been so nice to talk to you. We've loved being able to hear your story, and you seem like the exact same person that I met 2 years ago. So that's really that's really good to hear, and you just seem like such a positive, strong person. So we've just, yeah, it's been amazing.
We really appreciate you sharing your story with us and talking us through all of it. I know it's not obviously easy, but it's inspired me a lot, and I think I definitely will think long and hard about my life. And
yeah, and to get your story out there and to make it public, and as we said, if it can just help one person, that will make a difference.
Yeah. Yeah, thank you very much. And I apologise for my terrible Wi-Fi in the countryside of Hampshire and probably my terrible English accent, which maybe some of the Aussies might not know. And yeah, thank you for having me on. And I love listening to your podcast and what you guys are doing. And hopefully one day, Leah, I'll be back in the boxing ring. That's definitely one thing I would love to do again. Miss it, that's for sure.
What do you describe yourself as? A wannabe athlete?
Yeah, that is literally my motto. I'm a wannabe athlete. I love pretending I'm an athlete.
Yeah.
I'm not, but...
I think I'm pretty hardcore a lot of the time, but, you know, haven't got anywhere yet. Anyway, speak to you soon, Rich. Thanks so much.
You stay healthy. Bye.
See ya.
Thank you for listening. We really appreciate your support. If you enjoyed this episode, please like, subscribe, and leave a review at Finding Our Balance.
You can also follow us on Instagram and Facebook to keep up to date on our journey to finding our balance.